we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news.
Faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
Worked at ABC News, work at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
General Myron, thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message. Managing the message.
Trying to turn politics and the serious issues of our life into entertainment.
Managing the message.
Thank you, sir.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis. Overkill.
48 hours to war. Dun, 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 dun. Showdown to Saddam.
In wartime, seeing is not always believing.
The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Mr. Secretary,
to follow up on Jamie's question a little bit, I thought I answered that.
Media war.
Either with us or you're against us.
Outcome is assured.
What about Al Jazeera in that, publishing those gruesome pictures of dead soldiers?
I think there's something that is culturally Arab about that.
Hey, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio, News Dissector Radio, Progressive Radio, talking about media issues that often don't get much discussion in the media and in the news. And today I was going to be talking with ISIS, with a prominent scholar from Berkeley and Johns Hopkins, Dr. Abbas Kadim. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to reach him. We haven't as yet. But the key point here is that clearly we are moving into an intensification, an escalation of a conflict based on psychological factors as well as political and military ones. Clearly, the beheading of Americans is enough to get anybody, or Brits, gets everybody upset. When Saudi Arabians are beheaded by the Saudi Arabian government, there seems to be less worry, less attention paid to it. But in this particular case, we have a situation where world attention is focused on this. President Obama has vowed to carry out airstrikes. He's now saying no ground troops, but who knows? There could be ground troops. And the French have agreed to also bomb Iraq. There's going to be an increase in military conflict and combat there for sure. And we've already started to have airstrikes in Iraq and pretty soon in Syria. The question is this a conflict that the United States can win? What's behind it? How should we understand it? And what, if anything, can we do about it? And this is one of the big problems here, is trying to understand the impetus for this. Clearly, the United States is in trouble. Good. Clearly, the United States is in trouble trying to understand all this. And so I'm very pleased to have our guest joining us now from Washington, D.C., to give us a little perspective about how this conflict looks through the eyes of people in the Gulf, in the Arab world. How should we understand it? This to me is a really critical question, because we're in a situation where it's very hard to know all the players, for example, particularly if there are various factions and forces within the Arab world. And so it's difficult to actually be able to to actually be able to know who they are and what they stand for. Are they friends? Are they enemies? Or in some cases, are they both? This isn't really clear. So if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, telling us a little bit about your own research and work. Unfortunately, we got a little confused here in connecting with you. And tell us a little bit about your own research on this crisis that's now erupting, the ISIS war is how it's being called.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm Dr. Abbas Kadhim with the Foreign Policy Institute at Johns Hopkins University, originally from Iraq, being in the U.S. for about 22 years. I've been teaching anywhere from the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey to Stanford University, now with Johns Hopkins. Held some positions before, like with the Iraq Embassy, and I've been writing extensively on Iraq, on the region, politics and security in the Gulf, Iran. So that's the region that I've been working on. And also by training, I worked on my PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, working on Islam theology and politics.
So right now, I mean, how would you, what stage are we in this conflict? The president and the Congress has now voted support for training forces in Syria. There seems to be a go-ahead to increase bombing in Iraq. The Iraqi government seems a little more careful about all this. It says it doesn't want foreign ground troops, says it wants to be careful so that civilians are not bombed. How would you characterize this moment when these forces are kind of lining up on the battlefield?
Well, in the United States, there is a state of chaos as to how to deal with the crisis. Watching the hearings in Congress reveals how deep the division is within Congress, between Congress and the administration, and that is not a healthy sign. Until now, we have not reached a consensus or anything close to a consensus on how to handle the problem. Even those who agree with the administration that intervention is necessary, they don't agree on the type of intervention that is necessary. There are people in the Congress who would like to see an all-out war on ISIS, that is to involve the United States with all of its might and the might and power of its coalition. And they do not agree with the president on taking certain options off the table, such as the ground troops. And then there are those who do not want to involve the United States in the fight, similar to what happened in 2003, out of either ideological positions or because they do not agree or they do not see any plan or an end state to what the situation is. I think it is healthy to have a debate, but you know, when the debate gets so protracted and without any clear vision on how to tie the loose ends, I believe that it doesn't bode well for what we are trying to accomplish in Iraq. That's where we are.
I'd like to share some an analysis with from the great world systems theorist Emmanuel Wallerstein. I don't know if you know his work.
Of course.
And he has written about this. And, you know, his view seems to be very similar to yours, you know, in terms of chaos. And he's saying the explanation is simple. The United States is in serious decline. Everything is going wrong. And in the panic, they're like a driver of a powerful automobile who has lost control of it, doesn't know how to slow it down. So instead, it's speeding it up and heading towards a major crash. The car is turning in all directions and skidding. It's self-destructive for the driver, but the crash can bring a larger disaster. You know, that's not a very encouraging insight into the state of play right now, where, you know, none of these forces seem agreed and share a consensus. And after announcing, you know, these airstrikes, it seemed as if the initial reaction in the Arab world was, thank you very much, but we're not really interested. And, you know, maybe they're being coerced by Kerry's visit. Maybe they're being pressured. But it seemed as if initially, you know, they didn't have the same enthusiasm for this war that, you know, American media seem to bring to it, and given, you know, the sense of we're fighting evil and all the self-righteousness that a lot of American television is capable of.
Well, you know, the biggest problem in the United States is not the decline, and if I may be allowed to disagree, I believe we have a very strong military. We do have a very strong state, and as such, our biggest problem with the Middle East has been more of a problem of ignorance rather than a problem of weakness. The biggest problem of the current administration, for example, that it is listening to the same tired voices that caused us to be in this chaos in the first place when they were involved in the 2003
Are you talking about the neocons? Are you talking
not just the neocons? You know, we, Washington D.C. Is full of experts, and to use the words of Secretary Kerry, he said some of them who are called experts, and the administration, as the previous administrations, have relied on called experts rather than real experts, people who were tweeting just a few weeks ago on Ukraine and Ebola and Boko Haram and everything else, even the World Cup. When Iraq erupted, all of them switched to be tweeting tweeting on Iraq, and they became overnight experts of Iraq. And now they are the ones who are advising the administration when they really themselves need to be advised on the alphabet of the problem in Iraq. And that is the nature of the relation between the think tank community, mostly quasi and pseudo experts, with the administration. And also, let's not forget that in the region, which is what you touch on, it's very important. The region is not so enthusiastic about this fight because many players in the region are, in fact, benefiting from ISIS. Turkey is making a kill from the smuggled oil that goes through Turkey, as Lu'ay al-Khatib, a world-scale expert on energy, says. The only way for smuggled oil is through the southern corridor of Turkey. Oil barrel right now sells for $100 in world market. They get it for $25 from the smugglers, and you know that's a golden goose. Why kill it? The Saudis are very interested in using those people because they do serve Saudi ends in weakening governments that are rivals for Saudi dominance, such as Iran and Iraq and Syria. And why not doing that? The only reason why Saudi right now is signing on and is because of two things. One, the United States has turned its way, and if you've seen, there have been even a huge change in our big media, where a few articles actually were published in the United States criticizing the Saudis. Such a great phenomenon. And also the fact that they realize right now, the Saudis, that the threat of ISIS has gone beyond Iraq and Syria, and the spillover of it is actually coming to their own land. So they'd rather fight the ISIS danger and terrorism outside their own territories rather than fighting them in Riyadh and Jeddah.
So now, you're somebody who's unusual in the sense you're from Iraq. You studied in the United States. You're from the culture. You speak the language. You know the players. And yet, in many ways, although people in the know, you know, who I've met, you know, have a great deal of respect for you, your voice is not really out there very much on Fox News and MSNBC and American media. How do Americans understand the situation when it's coming to them through a filter of a very partisan news system that is conspicuous by its absence of Arab voices?
Well, because I don't tell them what they like to hear. I just came back from Iraq, spending 3 weeks there, and I arrived after the mid of August. And as a good citizen and someone who was trying to sort of share some of this with the people in policy making, I emailed directly the people who work for all key senators in the Congress, and I got no response from anyone except for two senators whose staff said basically they are too busy to talk to you. But they are, and they spoke with me for a few minutes, that's the only case. One senator, in fact, was the one that accepted to, his staff accepted to meet, and we met. And the others, I dropped by their office, and one of them spoke with me outside the door for about 5 minutes. And we talk here about a senior fellow at Johns Hopkins. So imagine, they are more interested in different people who feed them different kind of information. And it's I would say that what happened to the response that I got, and again, I was coming from Iraq, and I was there in the middle of the deep crisis when ISIS took Mosul over, and I was there walking among people as an Iraqi through three provinces, an expert with a PhD in American education. What happened and the response I got from the senators have been scandalous, to say the least.
Well, what does this say to you about the understanding of the American people? I mean, our focus here is the media. Okay, I did two books on the media coverage of the Iraq War in 2003 and 2000 to 2007. You know, I did a film about it as well, critical of American media coverage. But nobody seems to have learned very much, have they? And it seems to me for most Americans, it's very hard to sort of tune into this and understand it with any depth, with any background, with any context.
Well, the U.S. population has a lot to deal with. I mean, we have a vicious media cycle over the 24 hours that covers all kinds of issues and problems and around the world. The Middle East for them sounds a very remote problem. It is not close to us, and for many people, rightfully so, do not see the threat until it is really brought to them and served to them in an easy way. The media is not doing that job because there seems to be a consensus, even though the outside you see some disagreement among the big media, but ultimately they take their information from the same so-called experts and analysts. Normally you do not put too much of the blame on the U.S. populace. This is the way the United States population is more of, interested in the domestic issues rather than the foreign policy issues. But I believe that what the disturbing part is the lack of understanding within our own policy or foreign policy making people, those who are interested in running the country's foreign policy and dealing with crises in places like Middle East and other places where American interests are at stake. And ultimately, it is the level of information and the level of understanding of these people that counts, because experience showed that our government has done things in the past, 2003 or before or after, when it was completely against where the American populace opinion was. So it doesn't matter how much our population knows or where it stands. Ultimately, it is what the government decides to do. That's our system. I'm not criticizing here. This is the way the system works. But in fact, we don't seem to have the required knowledge, the required understanding, and quite frankly, the required resolve among our political establishment to get things done and get them right.
So you have this elite that basically agrees with itself or is shaped by its own preoccupations and forces. And you have a public that's really underinformed about this. So now along comes something very dramatic, a beheading. You know, not only a beheading, but a beheading on YouTube, something that's very vivid. So in a sense, ISIS, you know, basically called attention to itself and in a way triggered this reaction, you know, and the drama surrounding it. Why did they do that, in your view?
Well, they do it mainly because that's one of their tactics of inflicting fear and literally crushing the resolve of the communities to resist them and to fight them. It is somehow similar to what we have read in the history about the Mongol invasion and other brutal invasions in ancient times or even medieval times. When these images are projected, people tend to flee rather than to stay and run the risk of facing the same fate of those on the YouTube. And that is one way to do it. And of course, still there is also the hatred and the level of barbarism that is involved among and you know and the behavior of these people. I mean, you talk about literally psychopaths who are going around killing people indiscriminately. The beheadings, of course, have been going on for a long time. The problem is that we only paid attention to them when, you know, and rightfully so also, and unfortunately, the reality is to say that, you know, when Americans and Europeans were shown on YouTubes, we felt here in the United States that this is touching us. But let's remember that before these beheadings, which were, you know, no less, you know, tragic than any other beheading, there were a lot. 1,700 people were killed in Camp Spiker in central Iraq, just north of Baghdad, on the couple of days when Mosul or after Mosul fell. And these were killed completely. They were armless, unarmed, and they were simply killed and liquidated because they were Shia, and that's what happened. These are not the ISIS people, but the tribes in north of Baghdad who committed that atrocity, mainly the tribe of Saddam Hussein himself. Then ISIS did the same thing to the Yazidis, and Christians also. I mean, I went to school in Mosul, and when I was in Iraq to college, and for the first time in 2,000 years, Mosul has no Christians in it, and I think this will be a shame on our generation, that was the generation on our watch that this happened. And to be honest with you, the reaction of the world, even in the United States, was not equal to the tragedy of getting all the Christian community of Mosul out. And we had a conference in D.C. Last week, and you know, people who came here to support Christianity and in the Middle East and the Christians in Iraq and Syria. And unfortunately, we had one of the U.S. senators standing on the podium and just saying, you know, basically, we only can support you conditionally, and that's a problem. It was more of a political speech that ended up withdrawing his support from the Christians in the region. There is a lot that we need to do as a country to get grasp of the magnitude of the problem, the danger of it, and the threat it forms or poses to U.S. Interests in the region and also to the interests of people who are interested in international peace and stability.
Do you have any hope that as this conflict deepens or as it becomes more of a main news story, that the media will rise to the occasion and do a better job than it's done? Or will we constantly go from incident to incident, atrocity to atrocity, event to event, and the more gory it is, the more attention it will get? I mean, in some ways, media attention, elevated all of this, selective media attention, that is. So, you know, we're a country which has a government, but it also has a media system that seems to have more impact on how people understand what's going on.
Well, the big media has been dealing with every crisis in a mechanical way, unfortunately. There isn't any longer the passionate reporter or the reporter with a mission to do the work with passion and conviction. It is more about the ratings right now and more than anything else. But, you know, there is, let's be fair, there are so many people in the media who are doing an admirable job. And, you see that they are working in an honest way to try to educate the people. It's just how much influence they will have at the end of the day. It is the balance of how much money there is involved and how much, what kind of ratings and viewership that is available for any message that is being spread. I do hope that people will stop and think about the level of misery that is happening in the region. You know, I was in Iraq and I walked myself among those people, the IDPs, the internally displaced people, who were given a choice. Well, the Shia were not given a choice, basically. Those who survived were the ones who fled before ISIS took over. The Christians were given a choice between convert or die. Those I saw in Karbala and Najaf having fled Mosul, it breaks your heart. People who, where the family is split in three parts, one part in Najaf, another part is in Kurdistan, and a third part that was abducted, and nobody knows where they are. And every family has been touched by both death and separation of members of the family. And, and they are living in subhuman conditions, and literally in schools and other places with no adequate support. That misery, if we really get close to it and touch it with our own hands, we will stop looking at the, hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah. We will stop basically focusing on the semantics of or theoretical issues of the conflict and really get closer to the human element and the human dimension of the crisis.
Well, Dr. Abbas Kadim, a scholar from Berkeley at Johns Hopkins University, do you have a website or a place that we can send our listeners to read more of your work?
I don't use that, but basically everything I have, it comes out right away on Twitter. It is at Dr. Abbas Kadim, DrAbbasKadhim.
Well, I think
that's where I get everything crisp and easy to digest.
Well, I want to thank you again for joining us on Media Channel Radio. I want really to urge my media colleagues to reach out to you and include you in the dialogue and discussion of what's happening in Iraq, for not only because of your passion and your caring about ordinary people, but also, and I think this is most important, okay, your knowledge of the culture and of the people. Thank you again for being with me.
Thank you. It's an honor being with you, and thanks for having me.
We're going to take a break, but we've had a couple of problems here. So we're going to move on to our next segment, our next interview in a moment or two. Hopefully we're going to be able to find Sawari and the people from, the fabulous Sahara News Network, which has been covering events in Nigeria. And he will share his perspectives not only on those events, but also on how these events are or not covered in the media. You're listening to PRN FM. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Sanders station carries no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, buy a Coke, buy a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned babies.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's the drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Time is right, and ratings pressures.
News Goop, what we need to know. News Goop, what we want to know. We got News Goop, what we think we know. But the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor. News Goop,
what we need to know.
News Goop,
what we want to know.
We've got News Goop,
what we think we know.
Got remote control to choose a show. But the more we...
On the one hand, there's the public's right to know. On the other hand...
I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio, talking about media issues. We've just are trying to reach a leading Nigerian journalist from the Sahara News Network, promised to be with us. This seems to be a constant problem in getting people to be there when we want them there. But, you know, we're not unique or alone in that. In Nigeria, as you may have been reading or knowing, you know, we're in a situation where there's been an increase in conflict. There's the Boko Haram Islamic terror group, which is creating or trying to create its own caliphate in Nigeria. There are kidnapped girls and kidnapped other people in this conflict. There's a government, I guess, most known for its corruption and its inability to, you know, inability to be responsive and democratically accountable for what it does. We've had mounting violence in Nigeria, including, you know, some onset of Ebola in that country, but largely in other parts of West Africa. We've had a recent incident in Lagos, the capital, where a church, giant church building, basically collapsed and collapsed in a way that looked very much like what happened to Building 6, Building 7, rather, here at the World Trade Center. It sort of pancaked as if it had been blown up. And 67 South Africans, we don't even know how many Nigerians were in that church, synagogue church, when this happened. So you've had every week and every day more and more incidents about what's happening in the country with the largest population in Africa. The focus of the American media has been largely on the Ebola threat, the disease that sort of resurfaced that had been in Africa in the 70s and perhaps earlier. It sort of disappeared and has now come back and spreading particularly in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and other parts of West Africa, representing a tremendous danger, a tremendous threat to life and the future of those countries. People in Liberia say the whole country of Liberia is at risk, is being threatened because of this particular crisis. So, you know, it's a hard story to follow when there's so much going on in the world and Africa gets so little attention in the world, unfortunately. But we are going to keep trying to reach Omoyele Sowore and see if we can get him on the phone to talk with us about these issues. But, you know, the problem of all of this has to do with sort of two sides. It's, you know, a lack of media interest, which is then justified by saying, well, there's a lack of public interest. The public is not interested because doesn't know anything about it, doesn't get a lot of information itself about the background, the context of these stories. So we have a whole continent, which was known for many years as the dark continent, dark in part because the media wasn't shining any light on it. Now we have a crisis there that's of giant proportions involving millions of people, and it's sort of treated as an afterthought in the American media. Last week, we spoke with Lisa Vives, who does the Global Information Network, who covers African stories and talks about its significance. You know, here in the United States, Africa is a connection for millions of African Americans who share history and heritage with the continent. May not have a lot of knowledge about it, but they are, you know, concerned and interested in it. And the problem is, again, to interest more people, you have to interest the media, to interest more people, and the cycle goes on. And unfortunately, we're in a situation where, you know, it's hard. Some of the folks who are involved in reporting on Africa are not accessible or not seen very much in the mainstream media. And as a consequence, they themselves don't know, don't know how to reach out to the public, how to speak to the public, how to share their concerns with the public. So it's a communications problem on many different levels. And, you know, it's difficult to connect sometimes when people say they want to do it, other things come up. And I'm trying to send him an email right now, to try to get him on the program. So, you know, this is a constant situation that we're in, you know, in the media. You know, everybody's sort of blaming each other for why there isn't adequate coverage. And at the same time, you're finding a situation where I'm trying. I'm sorry. I'm here by myself. I don't have any team kind of on the phone working, you know, who work with me in this respect, although Jason's on the board doing a great job trying to connect with him. So we'll try to do as best we can to connect you with this story. I think it's important. I think it's extremely important. You know, this weekend, Sunday, African American parade in Harlem. Again, a sense of community pride and a sense of community heritage. So it's not an issue that's far away from most people. It's an issue that connects to them. Sunday at noon at the a law school in Brooklyn, downtown Brooklyn. There's the Brooklyn Book Festival, and I'm going to be there with Charlene Hunter Gault, formerly of PBS, and a number of other writers talking about Nelson Mandela's impact in America. All of us have written books about Mandela, have something to say about him. That's going to take place at high noon at the Brooklyn Book Festival, which is one of the great book festivals in the country. So there is interest. There are people who are connecting to this, who do care about it. But finding them, getting them involved is not always very easy. And what I'm trying to offer here on this program is a look at, you know, the world we live in and how good a job or bad a job the media is in covering that world. We're in a situation where the media resources in America are thinning out, as they say. Many much more entertainment news, much more online celebrity news, more tweeting, more Facebooking, less reporting taking place in many news outlets. And the consequence of that is that people end up knowing less. When you ask them about, you know, Nigeria or wherever else, they can't really have a conversation with you because they don't know. It's not their fault that they don't know. So That's why MediaChannel.org exists, to try to offer perspectives on what's happening in many parts of the world, and that we're not getting here in the United States. We are in a, you know, going to be a march on Sunday for global climate justice. It's a global issue. Everybody realizes it. It's going to be the biggest march of its kind probably in the world. Fear in many circles, including very well-informed ones, is that the planet itself is on life support, that we are facing, you know, major crises. Noam Chomsky just wrote a piece basically that sounded like an obit for the planet. People who are in... Who are there are very concerned. So, you know, that's why we persist and try to do this. Joining me now, okay, is none other than Omoyele Sowore of the really impressive news network Sahara Reporters. We're talking about coverage of Africa. What's your take on it right now, given all the problems that you report on every day?
Yes, Danny, let me say good afternoon to all your listeners. I'm actually just from another event where this issue was a major discussion as to how one can decide to repel Africa in view of the fact that Africa had been at the very terrible receiving end of bad news reporting or bad news in general. But my take, as you know, is very simple. Africa has a reality, Africa has a humanity, and the Africa reality cannot be detached from its humanity. So there's no doubt that in reporting Africa, if the preponderance of news is bad news, it has to be reported, especially as it has something to do with, dictatorship, diseases, and, you know, the atrocious leadership on the continent. It can't remove that, and Africa cannot settle for less, you know, than the best, because Africa's resources support almost the rest of the world. Africans cannot be making cocoa without, you know, enjoying chocolate. Africa cannot be a source of oil and gas for the rest of the world, whilst people cannot afford to have electricity or drinking water. So these are realities. These are the African realities on the ground. But what we do, as you know, is that we are taking initiative to make sure that in telling the story, we tell it so truthfully, because it's our continent, it's our countries that are involved, it's our people, it's our humanity. So,
what's interesting to me a lot about your approach is you're not waiting for the big media to cover Africa. You're not.
Absolutely.
You're not waiting for, you know, more reporters to arrive from New York or Washington D.C. You're saying to Africans, become reporters yourselves. Become citizen journalists. Cover your realities the way you understand and know them. And we will help you through Sahara Reporters by bringing this online, on YouTube, on all kinds of other social media to get this story out. And I think that's a very innovative approach. How did you come to that?
We came to that because of the need for Africans to seize also what I describe as a technological moment. There are 100,000 users of cell phones in Nigeria alone. There are more people using cell phones in Nigeria than you have in Canada. So instead of just sitting down there and, you know, paying bills to take, you know, telephone companies, use those devices, you know, to report your reality, and that's what we're doing. We are curating on these reports as they come from Africans themselves. We are not waiting for a guy with a crystal ball who is sitting down in Cameroon or Ivory Coast in a five-star hotel to report on African affairs using people they call fixers. So the fixers are reporting directly to us, you know, and we don't give them those kind of labels. They are citizens, you know, legitimately reporting what they're seeing and happening in a way that is passionate. And as you know, some of these reports have helped us to mobilize people to the barricades. You know, it has become a tool and weapon to fight back against authoritarian regimes in Africa. It has led to a lot of changes. Now African leaders know that all the eyes that are looking at them are not blind, and they are recording something. And I think it's put a lot of them on the run, and it's put their feet to fire.
Can you give us some examples of some of the stories that you're reporters, the citizen journalists of Nigeria are actually covering that are not really being covered in the mainstream?
I'll give you an example. We were one of the outlets that started reporting about the abduction of the girls. It took 2 weeks after we reported that the girls had been abducted before the mainstream media even mentioned it or paid attention to it. And then it took another 2 weeks before it became a global movement. And it took maybe another month for it to be around, and then everybody forgot about it. But we're still on the case as we speak. We're still looking for the girls because they have not been found. Whereas, you know, the mainstream media internationally, the activists on the social media, and also Hollywood, you know, and their partners within the polity have moved on. We haven't moved on. And this is very important, this, you know, that you can still have information about things that otherwise could have been forgotten. You know, we recently reported about the Nigerian minister who went and bought BMWs for twice the cost of them. And for the first time in a long time, we got half fired because we were persistent using social media. You know, the point I'm making is that this style of media has returned agency and authority to people in a way that it has never done before, especially our area of influence, Nigeria.
It's not just vaguely informing people. It's fighting back against abuse, against corruption. It's naming names. It's shaming people who are on the take. And I think that's a kind of media that's much more proactive and can have much more of an impact. I think that's why so many young Africans are attracted to what you're doing and participate in it. Tell us exactly what kind of programming you're offering now.
Well, you know, as you know, we've gone completely multimedia, which is that we have a very, very vibrant news website. We have and online TV and radio, and all of these are being used or helping Africans to interact. And I can tell you something, that African leaders, or leaders anywhere in the world, are usually very, very scared of interaction, because it is when you have interaction that you have coalitions, and coalitions that can become movements, and the movements can lead to revolutions, and all of them are afraid of this.
Also, you know, one of the things I think that about your programming, and that's why I'm urging people to check out Sahara Reporters, okay, online. See what you do. You also are offering humor, okay, commentary, even drama, music, culture. It's not a one-dimensional approach to just the headline hit parade. It's a programming that really engages you and interests you in learning more about Africa. And I think that's a really brilliant mix, if you will, that's missing from even our own coverage in the United States. It's interesting. Of course, here we have, you know, the comedy channel, which is probably the most popular news channel, okay, because of Jon Stewart or, et cetera. But it's because people find so much wanting in journalism, which can be very boring and very narrow in its approach.
You're right. And I think that's what we say about our operations, that, you know, Africa is a lot more than hunger and starvation and bad political leadership. It has a very vibrant culture. It has color. Africa has humor. You know, and Africa has musical instruments, and, you know, Africa has singers, they have movie stars, you know, Africa produces good movies in a way. So all of these are also part of the package that we're offering to the world, you know. That's why we use satire, we use news, we use humor, we use music. And, you know, but most importantly, we focus on things that have prevented Africans or Africa from becoming one of, you know, becoming a shining light of humanity. And we think it is likely due to atrocious leadership. And we do not spare leaders, African leaders, who have been turning the hand of the clock backwards for the continent. But all of this, you know, when you're drawn into our news about politics, you're also likely to find music. You will find humor. You will find music, and all of the packages that Africa represent is there.
So let's just talk about two stories, current stories in Nigeria that have gotten some attention. The first is, of course, the Boko Haram situation, where Boko Haram, after the IS or IISS or whatever, Islamic State, declared a caliphate. They said they were going to declare one, too. It also seems like an Islamic terror movement in some respects. And then just recently, a major bombing in Lagos of a big church there that seemed very suspicious and took a lot of people's lives. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Boko Haram has been around for a long time, and I presume that they will be around for a little longer. Again, you can't take it away from years of corruption, because the reason why Boko Haram is flourishing today is because the Nigerian army had been destroyed by corruption. As a matter of fact, Boko Haram is using most of its weapons captured from the Nigerian army to kill villagers, to overrun communities and create a territory for itself. So the scariest thing about Boko Haram is that it's taking over villages and taking parts of Nigeria and declaring it its own caliphate. As a matter of fact, its caliphate has been declared as an agent of the one by ISIS. So it's very disturbing. They're killing people, they are beheading, and they're doing the same exact things that the other guys are doing over there in Iraq and Syria. With regards to the collapse of the building of the church, well, it's the interesting thing about it is twofold. One is also this whole role by religious organizations in Africa. There's just this mass hysteria because, again, it takes you back to bad leadership. It takes you back to atrocious conditions of our people. Now, the churches are flourishing, just completely capitalizing on the socioeconomic conditions of Africans to sell them hope. And now over 300 people in this building collapse. We're in a building and it collapsed, this big church. And 67 of them were South Africans. So nobody can tell what happened to the building, and we may likely not know what happened to the building because the owners of the building, as the church is claiming, that they saw an airplane fly over the building and it collapsed a few minutes after. But there's also another concern that they actually built a five-story building on a spot that ought to take two-story, and that could have led to the collapse of the building under the weight of those things. So that's where we are.
So, but at the same time, these are enormous events, certainly in Nigeria. They're enormous events in world news, but they don't get the kind of play necessarily that helps people understand what the people of Nigeria are going through and suffering. This is something that I think if we're going to create a global community, if we're going to create a world of shared concerns about, peace and human rights and economic fairness, it can't just be a model just for the 99% so-called in the United States. It has to be a global approach. And in fact, it was in Nigeria where you had a bigger Occupy movement than anyone else in the world.
Absolutely. And, the good news, Danny, is that we somehow have managed to seize this moment we have now to report on events as they are happening instantaneously from Africa. And we don't used to get that. And it has always been my position that African events cannot be reported accurately by a local newspaper. No matter how you look at it, the New York Times is a local newspaper, local to New York City or the New York area. Or the Los Angeles Times is a local newspaper, local to Los Angeles. So they cannot report accurately or, fervently the way we would report on Africa, because that's our home, that's our continent. We understand the geography, the mannerism of our people, the culture, and the nuances of reporting, which is lacking when foreigners come and report issues on our behalf. And beyond that, they don't have the time to actually sit down and dissect. They are counting words. You got to write, report about the entire African continent, and you can't report more than 500 words, maybe in a week. And here are 1 billion people. So not even an average village gets a word from foreign reporting on Africa. But when you come to us, we got a lot to give you, you know, holistically, and we do that all day. Like I said, it's fresh, it's live, and it's instantaneous.
So in that respect, your news outlet, you know, is more than just a news outlet, first of all. It's a cultural institution. It's an institution for the exchange of ideas. It's attempting to provoke interest and challenge people to think more deeply about Africa. So, Sawori Mwele, I want to thank you again for joining us here on Media Channel Radio, for telling us more about your work. I want to urge our own listeners to check out Sahara Reporters and see if they will find it as interesting as I do and tell other people about it. So thank you again for being here, and thank you again for joining us every week on Media Channel Radio.
Thank you. Report yourself.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa.
Danny Schechter, your news dissector here. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Kadeem, Professor Kadeem, for joining us and giving us a perspective about Iraq from an Iraqi. And Oweli Sumwori, Oweli, to give us the same from a Nigerian. This is the kind of inside-out coverage you rarely receive anywhere else. To get in touch with me, write dissector at mediachannel.org. And, you know, hopefully I'll hear from you and get some more suggestions for how we can improve this program and continue to bring it to you to offer insights in the media by people who know it best and who work in it every day. Thank you again. And one more thing, just one more reminder. Sunday noon, the law school in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Law School, the Brooklyn Book Festival. And I'll be there Sunday talking about my book, Madiba A to Z, Nelson Mandela, and also with Charlene Hunter Gault, the great American African-American correspondent who's lived in South Africa for many years and has written widely about South African problems. So check it all out, and see you next week. Same time, same station.